Deutschlandfunk, Kulturfragen.
Mit Christiane Habermals herzlich willkommen. Der Kolonialismus ist eines der großen Menschheitsverbrechen, dessen Folgen wirtschaftliche und kulturelle bis heute in den afrikanischen Gesellschaften und in Europa zu spüren sind. Lange Zeit hat sich Deutschland mit seiner kolonialen Vergangenheit kaum auseinandergesetzt, auch weil die Deutschen in der Nachkriegszeit mit der mühsamen Aufarbeitung des Holocaust und der NS-Verbrechen beschäftigt waren. Man kann sagen, die Kolonialvergangenheit stand lange im Schatten der Schrecken der Shoah. Erst in den letzten Jahren hat sich das geändert, wurden koloniales Denken und koloniale Strukturen in Museen und Gesellschaft zunehmend hinterfragt. Doch in den letzten Monaten stand ausgerechnet ein afrikanischer Intellektueller im Zentrum einer neuen Antisemitismusdebatte in Deutschland. Dem Kameruner Philosophen und Postkolonialismus-Theoretiker Achille Mbembe wurde vorgeworfen, er würde in seinen Schriften den Antisemitismus verharmlosen, unter anderem, weil er die israelische Besatzungspolitik im Westjordanland mit dem südafrikanischen Apartheidsystem verglichen hatte. Er sollte daraufhin als Eröffnungsredner für die Ruhr-Triennale wieder ausgeladen werden. Auch wenn die Ruhr-Triennale dann Corona-bedingt ganz ausfallen musste, entspann sich eine intensive Feuilleton-Debatte um Mbembe in Deutschland, in deren Verlauf die Antisemitismus-Vorwürfe gegen ihn immer wieder wiederholt wurden. Was für Folgen hat das für die gerade erst beginnende Postkolonialismus-Debatte in Deutschland? Darüber möchte ich heute mich unterhalten mit Bonaventure Dikung, geboren 1977 in Kamerun. Er ist international agierender Kurator, Kunstkritiker, Leiter des Kulturraums Savvy Contemporary in Berlin, das sich mit zeitgenössischer Kunst und immer wieder auch mit den Themen Migration und Postkolonialismus beschäftigt. Hallo, Herr Dikung.
Hallo.
Herr Dikung, wie nehmen Sie die deutsche Erinnerungskultur wahr? Deutschland gilt ja im Ausland vielen als Vorbild dafür, wie es sich mit seiner NS-Vergangenheit auseinandergesetzt hat. Jetzt ist Deutschland das einzige ehemalige Kolonialland, das Aussöhnungsverhandlungen führt mit einer ehemaligen Kolonie, mit Namibia. Trotzdem gibt es sowas wie eine Konkurrenz zwischen den Erinnerungskulturen. Nehmen Sie sowas wahr?
That's a very difficult question. I will say Germany is definitely really one of the countries in the world that has really tackled its history, especially the more difficult parts of its history. You know, in this case, the history of the Shoah. And I think there's still much to be done there because it was a very violent history. And I think Germany has been very good at that. At the same time, and this is not really a comparison because, you know, one doesn't need to compare, but it's just history. We notice that there is a part of German history that has, for whatever reason, been massively ignored. It is also true that in the past years, things have been changing. You know, you've had institutions, museums that have tried to look at German colonial history. So I think they're getting there, but they're not yet there. So in the case of Namibia, of course, that is the closest, and Germany has been trying hard. But there are so many other instances, you know, the relationship to Cameroon, for example, and other countries in West Africa. But I'm even talking about, you know, the involvement of Brandenburg, Prussia, with Ghana, for example, you know, so there is a colonial history that goes back to the 17th century when, you know, Brandenburg was involved in the western coast of the African continent. And you see the history of the colonies in Germany everywhere. It's omnipresent. Thinking about, you know, street names, thinking about statues, thinking about even the Humboldt Forum and so on and so forth. So this history is omnipresent. The question is, how does one deal, how does one tackle that? And I think there's been a lot of restraint in dealing with this part of German history.
In Namibia, während der Verhandlungen um den Völkermord, auch mit den Herero und Nama, habe ich von den Herero und Nama-Gruppen öfter den Satz gehört, im Vergleich zu den Juden und dem Holocaust ist unser Genozid, ist unser Völkermord nur ein Völkermord zweiter Klasse. Hm. Und ein Genozid zweiter Klasse, und das liegt auch daran, weil wir schwarz sind. Hm. Ist daran etwas Wahres?
You know, I think I am strictly against a comparison of terror. I think terror is terror. I don't think there is a worse genocide. I don't think there's a better genocide. I think genocide is genocide. We have to stop that. One can critique the fact that there are certain blind spots in the Aufarbeitung of German history, you know, and that is clear. That we can work with statistics there. There are certain chapters of German history that have been ignored, you know, and that goes without saying.
Es gibt ja nicht viele prominente afrikanische Stimmen, die hier überhaupt Gehör finden, die hier in der Öffentlichkeit wahrgenommen werden. Achille Bembe gehörte dazu. Er ist in Deutschland mit vielen Preisen ausgezeichnet worden. Seine Bücher wurden gelesen. Er hat sich für ein neues Nord-Süd-Verhältnis eingesetzt und auch immer eine Entkolonisierung des Denkens in Europa eingefordert. Jetzt ist er Gegenstand einer Antisemitismusdebatte geworden. Sein Ruf ist beschädigt. Er muss sich rechtfertigen. Was bedeutet das für die gerade erst eingesetzte Kolonialismusdebatte in Deutschland?
Well, I think this whole debate has been rather a pity, I have to say. One might even be tempted to say there's been a certain intellectual bankruptcy, that the level of the conversation and discussion was rather low, and it seems as if some people were out to destroy Achille Mbembe for whatever reason. It is, one could even say, the discussion was quite racist.
In welcher Form?
In the way his arguments were twisted and the way he was attacked as an African. And some people actually wrote that he as an African is not supposed to mix up, you know, get mixed up, get caught up in German debates. And I thought that, but who is to decide what a thinker of the status of Achille Mbembe should be writing about or not? Politicians? No. In what world do we live? Achille Mbembe is one of the most important thinkers of our time. I mean, I'm not talking about just one of the most important thinkers on the African continent. He is one of the most important thinkers in the world today. I think that there are very few thinkers wherever in the world that have, you know, that track record, writing on things that are not only, that are not local, but of global importance, historical importance, philosophical importance. So I thought that the debate was too often very shallow. Who has the right to talk about what?
Sie haben ja auch, soweit ich weiß, vor ein paar Monaten den offenen Brief mit unterschrieben an Angela Merkel.
Yes.
Ist das richtig?
Yes.
Waren vor allem afrikanische, internationale Intellektuelle, die yes. ihre Solidarität erklärt haben mit Bembe. Wie blickt man in Afrika auf diese Debatte? Wird sie dort wahrgenommen?
Oh, definitely, definitely. It was in the newspapers in Cameroon, in Senegal, people were talking about it everywhere. Don't forget that Achille Mbembe is one of the founders of the thinking space in Dakar, Salon de la Pensée, I think, together with Fervin Saar and a couple of others. It goes a long way to show that he has a very broad support, not only within the intellectual circles, but on different levels, you know, artists and cultural workers were all behind him. And I think that is very important, you know.
Aber hat man diese Debatte als eine sehr deutsche Debatte wahrgenommen? Konnte man verstehen, worum es da eigentlich ging? Oder wie hat man das verstanden?
In somehow it was seen as a debate, although done in a shallow way, but a debate that was trying to pull an African thinker into the gutters. It also seemed as a very colonialist discourse in which a German politician or group of German politicians wanted to tell a thinker, a world-renowned thinker, the way discourse should be done. It also seemed like, again, the kind of colonialist posture, you know, which everybody, at least many of the people I talked to, kind of regretted. It seemed a very arrogant, you know, thing coming from Germany.
Bembe selber hat sich ja gerechtfertigt damit, dass er gesagt hat, er respektiere die deutschen Tabus, aber es wären nicht die Tabus der ganzen Welt.
Exactly. And I think that's important.
Wie wird in Afrika auf diesen Nahostkonflikt geblickt? Ist das vielleicht eine ganz andere Art und Weise, wie der Konflikt zwischen Israel und Palästina wahrgenommen wird, zwischen Deutschland und, ich sage mal, Afrika? Das sind natürlich viele afrikanische Gesellschaften, aber das sagen wir mal im globalen Süden. Wird das möglicherweise eher als ein auch kolonialer Konflikt gesehen, der dort stattfindet in Israel, stärker als in Deutschland, die natürlich mit ihrer eigenen Geschichte auf Israel und den Palästina-Konflikt blicken?
Well, I cannot speak for the whole of Africa. It's impossible for me to do that. But what I can say is that, at least from a lot of the conversations I've been part of, especially because of Africa's history being a continent in which most of the countries were colonized, most of the countries were oppressed, and are still oppressed, people tend to be on the side of the oppressed rather than the oppressor. And in the context of the Middle East, Palestine or Palestinians are oppressed. So it goes without saying that a lot of people look at that and sympathize with the cause of the Palestinians, which is something one should do. Just like, you know, with the Black Lives Matter in the US, people all over the world were sympathizing with the fate of black people in America because they've been oppressed for hundreds of years. You know, so I think that it is a natural instinct to be on the side of the oppressed rather than the oppressor.
Die Kolonialismus-Debatte hat ja so ein bisschen den Effekt, dass man wieder viel stärker auf Identitäten zurückgeworfen wird. Ist das nicht möglicherweise auch ein Problem, dass auch zum Beispiel Afrika, das sind zum Teil sehr junge Gesellschaften, die Teil einer globalisierten Welt sind, auch wirtschaftlich immer stärker teilnehmen an einer globalisierten Wirtschaft. Ist das nicht vielleicht auch ein Problem, dass über diese Postkolonialismusdebatte sie wieder zurückgeworfen werden, auf einen Teil ihrer Geschichte reduziert werden?
Well, I don't know, you know, these are very complex debates. Now, the issue of identity seems to me also one of those, you know, the word in German is scheinheilig, one of those strange debates, you know. Some people want to claim their identities and they don't want others to claim identities. Now, what does it mean? Every debate has something to do with identity. People want to claim their positions within societies and so on and so forth. Why not? We cannot reduce everything to identity, that for sure. But people that want and are fighting for their identities, the right to be a woman within a particular society and to live like that, the right to be able to live as a black man within a particular society, the right to have the same social standards as a Romani within a particular society, those are elemental things within life. That for sure. I don't know why there should be a problem with that. Okay. Now, it seems as if we are thinking of colonialism in the past. While I think we should be thinking and talking about coloniality or neocolonialisms, because it seems as if we're talking of colonialism as something, as a chapter that was closed, and now we're in this globalized world and everything should be fine. Therefore, people have to move on. That's what I kind of feel in this question you're asking. Now, you know that the lives people live on the African continent and different parts of the world are very much framed around the power structures that were put on within the colonial enterprise. And I'm talking about political and economic consequences. So if you look at a country like Cameroon, where the president has been in power since 1982, still supported by the French. If you look at the whole of the West African continent, where they're all using the CFA, which is still attached to the French franc, you know that there is a problem. If you look at a country like Cameroon, where 70% of its resources still go to French banks, you know there's a problem. You know, so colonialism is in no way over. It has just taken different forms. It's been malleable. You know, let's think of Nigeria, for example, where you had the big oil companies coming into Nigeria to extract oil. Now you can say it's just a Nigerian problem. No, it's not just a Nigerian problem. You know, it is also part of this colonial enterprise. So because when these big companies, they rip out the oil, it's also to satisfy the demands in the West, right? So what do they leave over? They destroy the whole land. Let's think about the seas, where the big tankers come and fish out the whole seas. So what should these people live from? And then these people step, the victims of this, they step on a boat tomorrow and they try to come to Europe. Then we sit here and we say these people are going back to some kind of identity discourse. No, we need a bit more rigor in this conversation. And I'll give you another example. You know, I grew up in Cameroon. My mother used to have a poultry farm where you'll have chicken running around the place. At some point, it became more expensive for people to buy chicken from that grew up in Cameroon than to buy chicken that was sent in from Europe. Why? Because the European Union had put up a subvention system that overflooded the market with sugar, with meat, and so on and so forth. And these things were sent to Africa at a dumping price. That is part of the colonial structure. That is part of the colonial enterprise, you know. So that chapter is by no way closed, you know. And I think that one thing Europe has to do is to also take upon itself its responsibilities. If you destroy other parts of the world, people would come here.
Ich spreche mit dem Kurator und Kunstkritiker Bonaventure Dikung. Herr Dikung, Sie haben gerade erst im Kunstverein Braunschweig eine Ausstellung mitkuratiert, in der es um Anton Wilhelm Amo ging. Man muss kurz was über ihn erzählen. Er wurde um 1700 herum als Kleinkind nach Deutschland verschleppt und genoss hier als Mündel des Herzogs von Braunschweig eine hervorragende Bildung. Er studierte an der Universität Halle und promovierte in Philosophie an der Universität Wittenberg. Was hat Sie an Amo interessiert? Sein Blick auf die Welt, auf Deutschland oder wie die Welt ihn sah? Oder kann man das überhaupt trennen?
I don't think you can separate them. But you know, in your introduction of Amo, it sounds like a beautiful Märchen, a beautiful story. Now, one has to start from the point that Amo was taken as a kid, separated from his family, and sold as an enslaved person. So we need to start with that violence, okay? Now, he comes through the Netherlands, through Holland, to Germany and studies. Now, what am I interested in? I'm interested in his thoughts. I'm interested in his life as a black man in a white space of the time, in the middle of the slave enterprise. I'm interested in his thoughts at the time. So in 1729, he writes this thesis, his dissertation, called On the Rights of the Black People in Europe. And I think that's a fundamental piece of writing, you know. And there were not many people, as you and I know, writing about that at the time, you know. So it demanded some courage. And this guy at this moment does a very clear, pragmatical legal argumentation why black people shouldn't be enslaved. A few decades after, you have people like Kant and Hegel writing all kinds of terrible things about black people, racist things, which I don't want to repeat here. But the greatness of this man is the fact that in this moment, he writes about the rights of black people. And I think that we need to, we cannot talk about how Black Lives Matter today without talking about what it meant for Amo to write this kind of a piece in 1729. I think that is worth thinking of.
In Berlin soll jetzt ja die Mohrenstraße umbenannt werden in Anton Wilhelm Amo Straße. Sie haben sich auch dafür engagiert, dass das passiert. Reicht das? Reichen solche Umbenennungen von Straßen, um eine Dekolonisierung des Denkens in Gang zu setzen?
I think the street names are just one example. But we do see that. I mean, we have a project at Savvy Contemporary called Colonial Neighbors, where we've been collecting references, evidences of German colonialism in German society. So it goes from books. So these racial, racist structures that actually stemmed from the colonial enterprise are still omnipresent. They're there. You see, even in children's books, in kids' songs, you know, they had Angst vom Schwarzen Mann, and so on and so forth. So they actually, it's not just street names. So this racism in the language, look at advertisement, look at the Sarotti, look at the coffee. These are all evidences of German colonialism within, and also in language, gehen Sie wo der Pfeffer wächst, and so on and so forth. You know, all these idioms and proverbs and so on that are racialized. I think we need to think about them. And I think that is what culture should also do. I always pledge for intellectual references, you know, so it's also about the curriculum. So if you go to the schools and, you know, go to the universities, what history is actually taught. So, and I think there you see an alarming absence of the colonial history in those spaces, then you know that there's a problem.
Interessant ist ja, Achille Bembe hat darauf auch immer wieder hingewiesen. Er hat gesagt, auch in Afrika muss das Denken entkolonisiert werden, nicht nur in Europa. Mhm. Und in Windhoek zum Beispiel, in Namibia, gibt es sogar eine von Trotta-Straße. Ich habe sie selber gesehen. Ist das nicht manchmal ein Widerspruch, dass gerade in Afrika zum Teil auch die Denkmäler stehen bleiben und nicht abgerissen werden?
But I'm telling you, that is exactly the problem. It's not about Germany. It's not about Europe. It's about the world. You know, even on the African continent, this process has to happen. You know, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o famously wrote the book Decolonize the Mind. And that is what he's talking about. It has to. We can decolonize structures, states, but we have to start by decolonizing the mind. There is a famous performance artist in Cameroon that goes around destroying the statues of French colonialists in Douala and other places in Cameroon. And he gets locked up all the time. Why? Because the state of Cameroon is still within this colonial corset. They're still in this colonial space. You know, you still have streets named after De Gaulle. We're talking about the same De Gaulle who, at the end of the Second World War, was responsible for taking out the black soldiers from the French army, the tirailleurs. You know, the African soldiers that were in the French army fighting at the front line in the First and Second World War, that were in Germany, that were massacred. They were used as cannon fodder. But at the end of it, De Gaulle and the Americans decided to take out all the black soldiers from the French army.
Warum?
Because they wanted to give the impression that it was a white army that won against the Germans. These people were bundled, these black soldiers coming from different countries on the African continent, some even from Asia, were bundled and sent to Senegal in a camp. And their dues were not paid. They fought for the French army, and the French army didn't pay their dues. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine the kind of violence in that? You know, the film The Count de Turay is based on the revolt because these people wanted their money and it was a massacre of them. So they didn't only fight for the French army, they were also massacred thereafter. This is history.
Savvy Contemporary ist ja ein Raum für zeitgenössische Kunst. Yeah. Welche Rolle spielt denn die Rückgabe afrikanischer Objekte für die zeitgenössische Kunst in Afrika oder auch überhaupt?
Well, first of all, at Savvy Contemporary, we concern ourselves with issues of restitution, of course, but we also concern ourselves with issues of rehabilitation. First of all, at Savvy Contemporary, we have 34 people from 15 different countries from around the world, and that is quite important. That is, in our opinion, the institution of the future. We're looking at things from different parts of the world. One of the projects we're working on for the next years is a commemoration of the book How Europe Underdeveloped Africa, which was written in 1972, and it was a very important book. We want to look at issues of development and underdevelopment as constructs. We're interested in different ways of writing histories. For example, looking at textiles, not looking at textiles just as aesthetic objects, but looking at the way textiles have been used as writing systems or surfaces on which people have written in the past, you know, but also performances, you know, the body as a side of discourse. So we're looking at the way histories have been transformed from one generation to the other using the body, you know. So when people say, well, Africans have oral cultures, we say, yes, we do have oral cultures, but we also have other cultures. We do have other ways of writing histories, you know, using books, because we do know that people have written on the African continent since time immemorial. And it's a fiction that people think that it's only through orality. And we do know that people have written in other forms, on textiles, with their bodies, through rituals, and so on and so forth. So we are complexifying the discourses.
Und das scheint notwendig zu sein.
Sehr notwendig.
Vielen Dank, Herr Dicko.
Ich habe zu danken.